You know, that, and I think it's so important that the great truths of Reformed faith, they are a comfort, they are a help to us, they are a tremendous value. What the thing to do is to bring people, other people, to the blessing we get from them, rather than to kick them, kick against them because they don't understand them. It's the attitude there.
Yeah.
Well, the dean of academics at Westminster was, when we talked to him, he was calling Francis Schaeffer a fundamentalist.
Yeah.
And I saw that that's group. We're not.
Oh, yeah.
I said, what are you then if you're not a fundamentalist? You know,
he's with what?
Well, the fundamentalists, yeah, that's another term. Now, they would distinguish and view the evangelicals as the fundamentalists would be outside the PCA. They'd be the Jerry Falwell and so on.
Francis Schaeffer.
Then in the PCA, he called Francis Schaeffer a fundamentalist.
He says he was one of the fundamentalists. I just said, well, then what are you?
This was who again?
The dean of the admissions
at Westminster.
Yeah, he's there now.
Oh, yes.
They probably means that in the term that some of these meant the evangelicals.
Yeah.
In other words, they mean.
The thing is, the evangelical faith we should stand for, and if you really stand for it, you're a fundamentalist. And we should try to promote it to win people to the Lord and to get them to accept the Bible and stand on these great doctrines. Then we can bring them the blessing of the Reformed. The assurance, the confidence that you're not going to fall aside, that it isn't you that holds you safe, it's the Lord that holds you. And there's great confidence, strength, and help in these great Reformed doctrines. But they're not a thing to fight over, they're a thing to bring people the blessing of. And the major thing is the evangelical, it's to reach people with the message. And then as Mr. Murray said, you look down and you see, come unto me, all ye. Then you look upstream after you're converted and you see, blessed are you, the chosen of my Father, the foundation of the world. We don't know who he has chosen, but he gives us our minds to use, to study and see what we need and to find the answer in Christ. And the devil is so clever. Taking good things and using them to get bad results.
It seems as though with each of the movements there was something, you know, it was this with Westminster and as faith that later became separation, something, anything to divert people from
the center,
the growth of the church and the advancement of the gospel, as well as solid educational work.
Just who had stood for the truth in their college, and they get there and they're gradually put into this narrow mold and losing their interest in the great things of the gospel. Oh, it was sad. And I think about our minister here, John Clark. He's a fine man, and he good central emphasis. And he went to Fuller for a year. And there at Fuller, he got a disgust with their attitude. This is the intellectuals all that matters. Listen. He got disgusted with that and came to Westminster for his last two. So he missed the first year indoctrination at Westminster. And I fear if he'd had the whole 3 years, he'd have been like the rest of them. Because he has a strong emotional liking for everything connected with Westminster. But his solid emphasis that he was led to the Lord by the InterVarsity before he went to Fuller. And that he's got. And his sermons are right down the line on the truth. Mm-hmm.
That was a wonderful service last night.
It was.
The dinner.
And that message of his, that wouldn't until been discussed with that message. But it was good.
Well, thank you.
It is now Friday, October 27th, 1989. And we're in Steve Haig and I, Jim Pakula, are in Dr. McRae's office, continuing the oral history interviewing.
Well, you would like to hear more, I think, about those at the end of my time at Westminster.
Yeah.
I think I have made clear in previous times how there was a gradual change there, and a particularly a strong change in the student body, because it was the cumulative effect of the teaching, I think, largely of Dr. Van Til, though there were others who seconded it and backed it rather strongly. And the end of it was, instead of the emphasis being on that which would make graduates who would advance the cause of Christ, reach souls for the Lord, and help people to grow in grace, the emphasis was on absolute agreement on 1,000 points. And every one of these points was vital to the true stand, and if you were off on one of them, you were on the way to complete destruction. It was that extreme attitude. And that attitude, when the new church was started, had the natural effect of having the recent graduates who took over the pastorship of these churches immediately try to put everybody into a very narrow, exact group, which was very contrary to the general attitude on a lot of secondary matters that had been taken by those who were really standing for the truth in the United States. And the result was, would inevitably be the production of a small group insisting on uniformity on 1,000 points and not having any great influence in the country. And there are many such groups now. There are dozens of groups in the country that have got their own idea on 100 minor points, and they have people who are very, very earnest and very strong in their argument on these particular points, but they're not reaching the country for the Lord at all. And they're not teaching any great number of people to grow in grace. In fact, I sometimes wonder whether how many of their people are growing in grace. I'm thinking now of the church that they started then, the so-called Orthodox Presbyterian Church. That church has, with a considerable-sized group of well-trained and able fellows, its growth in these 40 years or more has been really very, very little. I remember when there was talk about the Orthodox Presbyterian Church uniting, perhaps, with the Presbyterian...
Reformed Presbyterian Church, Evangelical Synod?
Yes, with that, or no, more particularly with the big one now,
PCA.
The PCA.
Oh, yes.
I believe it was Dr. Taylor who said in his magazine that it would make a big effect on the church, the infusion of 15,000 theologians into it. In other words, you have maybe 15,000 people, most of whom are trained to stand very strongly for 1,000 different points on which you must have uniformity, and that's not the way to advance the cause of Christ. Although individuals under their teaching may really grow in the Lord, I wouldn't say that. But I would say that it was destroying the great purpose in the foundation of Westminster Seminary, which was to carry on a Presbyterian testimony to the truth of Christ and of the Bible. Well, this was gradually growing during the time that I was there, and the students were becoming more and more that way. And to me, at first, it was a kind of a feeling, as I began to say, I'm just wasting my time. I am not accomplishing anything worthwhile. I've had that feeling very strongly my last 3 years. And then when I saw the great hostility of the students to Dr. Machen during the seventh year there, because he was working with people who were very earnest Christians, but who perhaps did not understand the Calvinistic teachings as fully as they did after the theological training they'd been given. And the idea was, we must separate from these people who don't agree with us on these secondary or even tertiary or quaternary points. And so I was feeling more and more unhappy. But it came to a crisis probably largely through the relation to Dr. Buswell, because Dr. Buswell was actively sending students from Wheaton College to Westminster and had been actively supporting them. And then these students were beginning to become so filled with the consciousness that they alone knew what the scripture teaches about theology, and that what they'd gotten at Wheaton was entirely wrong, because they had premillennialism there, they had the separated life there, they had these things that were some people perhaps emphasized too much. But that doesn't mean that they should be destroyed or not. And these students were thinking that Dr. Buswell was really very inferior to them now. They were treating him that way. That made it hard for him to keep on urging other students to come the way he wanted to. Dr. Machen was very anxious to maintain good relations with Dr. Buswell. I never heard of his criticizing Dr. Buswell. In fact, he nominated Dr. Buswell to be the second moderator of the new church, of which he was the first. But some of these people wouldn't vote for Dr. Buswell at all. And there was one middle-aged fellow who had taken a strong stand with the new group, though he had not been directly connected to Westminster, that some of the students nominated for moderator against Dr. Buswell. This man was very embarrassed that they did so. But it was that attitude. Well, let's see, so how it came to a focus. Oh, I think there was a letter from Dr. Buswell, which questioned certain of these matters, whether these students were being strongly taught against premillennialism, and whether they were being taught that worldliness didn't matter. And, well, after we left there, I remember two students, during our first year at Faith, there were two students, good friends at Wheaton, who came east. One went to Westminster and one came to Faith. And they met after the fellow had been to Westminster 6 weeks, and the fellow at Faith was quite surprised to see the other fellow had taken up smoking. And he said, that's the sixth point of Calvinism. Well, of course, he was kidding. But, I mean, it shows the emphasis that the fellow would change that quickly, that soon there.
Now, well, how did you happen to actually resign from the faculty?
Yes.
Did you let them know long in advance? Who else left?
No.
Why did you decide to do that?
Yeah.
How was it received?
Yes, well, let me lead up to that a little bit. We should say something about Carl McIntyre here, because he was quite prominent. For instance, after I had resigned, I met Joe Young six weeks, after I resigned. I met Joe Young, who was an instructor there in Hebrew. And Joe said to me, he says, "I don't have anything against you, but I'd like to wring Carl's neck." Well, I didn't like that idea that some had of thinking that Carl simply maneuvered me, because actually he hadn't said a word to me. I did speak to him, but he hadn't said a word to me about this. But McIntyre had objected to the attacks on premillennialism and on the separated life, and he had asked for a conference with the faculty. And at this conference, he spoke to them about how many of their supporters, like himself, believed in premillennialism, and that they would didn't like the idea of being constantly knocked in classes, and he wished they might have somebody on the faculty who was premillennialist. And he met with the faculty. I didn't say anything in the meeting. He just, at the end, he shook hands with all of us and left. It was a very pleasant meeting. And in the Beacon, he had made one or two statements critical. I don't remember he even made that in the Beacon before these things came to a head. But it it finally came to a head sort of by accident, you might say. They had the new church, and we were all, of course, supporting the new church quite strongly as we could. And one of the recent graduates was a pastor of a little church in West Philadelphia, which most of the faculty were attending. And he asked me if I would preach there on a certain evening, and I agreed to do it. And I noticed that his subject for the morning sermon was the return of Christ. And I thought, I will deal with another phase of the same problem. So I said, I gave him the subject, the millennial kingdom of Christ. And he then, when the announcements came out about the meetings, he had taken another subject. So when I went to the meeting, I said, well, I thought you were dealing with one aspect, I with another. Oh, no, he said, when you dealt with eschatology, I thought I should take a different one. But it was, you might say, his invitation led me do that. But since I did, now I had, during the previous fall, I had taught the course in Old Testament prophets. And I had done, as I always did in classes, I took the basic facts, went into them about the scriptural evidence, and then built upon it. And my impression was that all of us students of senior class, 5 days a week, my impression was that all the students agreed with the premillennial conclusions that I reached in the class in the Old Testament prophetical books. But the next semester, in two of the other professors were constantly answering in their classes the arguments that students brought up that they had heard with me, and were making a strong attack on premillennialism in that way. And so I simply took what I'd heard from students of attacks on premillennialism, and I got the scriptural answers to them. And there at this little church with Dr. Van Til and three or four other faculty members in the group, maybe 50 people there, I don't know, I gave a 60-minute sermon in which I answered all of the points that I knew of, that I had heard an attack of premillennialism. And Dr. Van Til told me later how he listened to the sermon. He said he liked what I presented. He thought it was very good. And then he says, I come up with an attack on millennialism. And it made me think that his thoughts were in philosophy rather than in scriptural interpretation, because everything I said led up to that. But he was very, very pleasant after the meeting, because everybody there was. Well, I went, I guess 3 days later, Dr. Kuiper spoke to the students at the supper. And after the meeting, it was Goddard, who was later librarian of Goddard and another fellow. They phoned me, and they wanted to speak to me. And they said that Kuiper had made a direct attack upon me in the meeting with the students. He said, can you imagine me talking in a sermon on little thing like the millennial kingdom? He says, I talk about the great things of the gospel and so on. They said it was a direct attack upon me, and they were very much irritated. They said that as far as the views were concerned, they agreed with him. And most of the students, they were pretty well brainwashed by that time. They agreed with him, but the attitude, the manner of going after me that way, they didn't like a bit, so they came and told me. Well, I saw what it meant a lot more than they did. I knew what had happened with even Dr. Machen when criticism was against Dr. Machen, why he was just put down as nothing for that year by the students. And I knew that this meant that the attack had begun, and that if I continued there, I soon have all the students convinced I was nothing, would never do anything, and I could go on teaching beginning Hebrew the rest of my life if I wanted to there, but I would never again have a chance to give the great things of the scripture. And of course, that you might say is minor to the effect on me. The major thing is what they're doing, taking all these fine young Christian fellows, and instead of turning out people who believe the great central truths of scripture, but are studying scripture to see what it teaches, rather than simply taking certain points handed down in creeds and just dealing with them exclusively and driving them home to people and making a little narrow group. Well, I felt I have to dissociate myself with that, from that, and make it clear. So I got busy and I wrote a statement of my regret that a small alien group had taken a great effort to advance the gospel of Christ and gain control of this institution, and that they attacked premillennialism. Most of their supporters are being premillennialists, or a tremendous number of them, and that they taught that it was perfectly all right to use intoxicating liquors and so on. And I took the various issues and I presented them. And I was helped some in preparing it by H. McAllister Griffiths, who had been a great hero, because he used to appear on the General Assembly defending the independent board. Dr. Machen said, oh, he liked to see Dr. Griffiths going up those stairs to the General Assembly platform, so on. And Wheaton College had given him an honorary doctorate the same week I got my PhD from the University of Pennsylvania. And Griffiths didn't affect the ideas I present, I don't think, at all, but he did give me certain improvements of wording here and there. And then I phoned Dr. McIntyre, and I read to him over the phone what I had written, and I said that they taught that it was all right to use these, and he said, say, and they do so, or they use them themselves, or something like that, which I put in. That was the only thing that he made any difference with, and that, of course, was entirely true. Because when I would go to Dr. Van Til's for dinner once a year, why, we would take a little walk ahead of time, and he would smoke on that walk usually. And I remember one time he said, now let's sin, Willie. And that, of course, irritated me, because to use the word sin lightly like that, if it's sin, we should have nothing to do with it. But to, well, that irritated me. And of course, Stonehouse, you remember I told you how he said it might be our duty to smoke if there was somebody there who didn't approve of smoking. And this attitude, this was the thing to go out and fight for, the Christian liberty to do these things that most American Christians thought were unfortunate. Well, I gave the statement to the papers, to the newspaper, and they put it on the front page. And, of course, they were glad to have anything to hurt Westminster. And, of course, I hated the idea of their hurting Christian testimony, but I saw the big Christian testimony just taken over and twisted by this attitude. And it was, I felt, in a way, like a man I knew of who got between two rival gangs in California and had to fight his way out. I felt sort of that way. Well, Edwin Ryan wrote the book on the Presbyterian conflict.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And he quotes in it the statement of the faculty, the faculty statement, and he quotes the student statement. Doesn't quote my statement. Oh. So their statements are attacking my statement. And it's most interesting. Oh yes, the student statement was at the supper in the dining club where about 2/3 of the students met. They heard about my statement, and Dr. Kuyper's son-in-law suggested the students make a statement and someone moved that he, that committee draw up such a statement, of which this fellow was chairman, and this committee drew up the statement. And that's the statement he gives here as the student's viewpoint. And here's a typical thing of the way they said. He says, we hope that no one will be misled by the assertion that, quote, practically every member of the faculty has entered upon a vigorous defense of an asserted right to use intoxicating liquors, a defense occasioned by the fact that certain faculty members themselves use intoxicants. This quote from me. And he says, we as students can honestly assert that the faculty has neither taught nor practiced anything out of accord with the historic Presbyterian position as based on the Word of God. Doesn't say, it gives you the impression that what I said was a lie, but it doesn't mean it at all. It's like two trains passing on different tracks. But they prepared those statements, and he quotes the two statements, but doesn't quote the thing they're attacking.
Did you get that down on me?
Well, I
was writing this in 1940, then went back into the Presbyterian USA Church.
Yeah, that was interesting.
And was assistant to the president at Princeton.
Eventually, yes, after.
And what article did he write in the Princeton alumni?
In the a bulletin. It is a little magazine they send out four times a year, I think. And they said, it said in it that they had been having him speak to the students of Princeton Seminary about Dr. Machen and his activities every year, speak to them in order to warn them against it. You know, it's really sad.
Why did he make that change, Edwin Ryan, back after writing the Presbyterian Conflict and defending Machen, to go back? He was president of the board of Westminster.
He was president of the board, but they, you see, it was eventually the same attitude that I found it necessary to fight, you see. He went with them, but eventually it was you had to just be on him. Eventually they turned against him.
And he probably then overreacted to that.
He was reordained. Yeah. Well, he had just, he had subordinated himself completely, had taken, stood with what they stood for, whatever he thought of. And in the end, it just got too much. And of course, when they began to realize that, then they began criticizing him. But, about this time, there was a young man whom I had had in my Hebrew class, and I knew him slightly. And I don't have any really clear recollection of him before that time. A little short fellow, and he came up to me because I continued teaching the remaining 3 weeks or so of school, and he came to me after class, and he says, Dr. McRae says, I'd like to tell you that I thoroughly agree with what you say. And his name was Francis Schaeffer. And then another fellow came, whose name was Douglas Young, G. Douglas Young, and who later was head of this school over in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And of course, I had good many talks with them. And they told me, they said, these professors, they dictate their material so fast that all you can do is just to write it down rapidly. You have no instant to think about anything. And then you have to memorize it for examinations. And they said, you just can't think about it. And of course, probably five-sixths of the students were single, but these two were married. And they said the single students, they just talk about it and they reinforce each other's loyalty. But they said, we go home and we tell our wives such. And they say, do you believe that? Do you really think that? And then he says, we have to stop and think about it ourselves. And the result was that the only ones there that escaped, I would say, from this were fellows who were already, who were married. That is, most of them. There was one other fellow who came on account of family reasons, but most of them that was the way. And so I had long talks with them and with Douglas Young's brother, John Young, and then Carl, Francis Schaeffer during that next summer helped us find a place to have the new seminary, found buildings we could rent for our students to be housed in, bought secondhand stuff to fix up these buildings. Oh, he just worked the whole summer on that sort of thing. But
who else was with you now in this effort?
And with Douglas John Young, and then Carl, Francis Schaeffer during that next summer helped us find a place to have the new seminary, found buildings we could rent for our students to be housed in. Bought secondhand stuff to fix up these buildings. Oh, he just worked the whole summer on that sort of thing. But
who else was with you now in this effort? Who had been at any faculty?
No, the faculty, they were.
You were the only one?
I was the only one of the faculty. But the president of the board of directors had just died, and they put Ryan in as his successor. But the vice president, secretary, and treasurer of the board all resigned. That was me.
And who were they? Do you recall?
Well, the secretary, the one I had addressed my letter to, was Samuel Laird, Dr. Laird.
Oh, yeah. Harold Laird?
Harold Samuel Laird.
Mm-hmm.
And I had addressed the letter to him, and then I'd given a copy to the newspaper, and then I was at a meeting that he was at, and he hadn't yet received the letter, so I read it to them there at the meeting publicly. And
well, who was your board? Did you feel that this was single-handed, or did you feel that there was something of a wellspring of, you mentioned the students, one of the keenest students, who else was helping this all come together besides Francis Schaeffer doing a lot of the legwork for some of the logistics there in Wilmington, but how about the board and as far as faith actually starting and the following following fall?
The following fall we started. And
did you feel like you were assembling a board at that point and a faculty, or how did that?
Dr. McIntyre had more to it than I did.
So he was very much active as well.
He was, of course, he had had the feeling that he was devoted to Westminster, and he revered Dr. Van Til, but the way they were treating him was really bad, and he felt if they had been willing to give premillennialism a fair hearing in the teaching, he might have gone along with it. He had a great loyalty to Kuyper, even to the end of his life. And Van Til, he went to Van Til's funeral, if you remember.
Yeah.
And I think Van Til influenced Schaeffer's his vocabulary, his manner of speaking a lot. So he said many things that sounded like Van Til's teaching, but I don't think they really represented, I think, his thought away from that.
Yeah.
And Van Til thought so, too, because he wrote that long paper in it. Say it, yeah. But the next 3 weeks, then they were the most, you might say, excited weeks of my life. I felt that it was I felt that they, I knew they would attack me strongly, and I felt the attacks would be less strong if I was present. So I went to every meeting. And I was supposed to give the baccalaureate address that year, but they've ordered to change, not have me do it. And Phil says, he says, the baccalaureate speaker is supposed to pray that God will bless these students. What would you do, pray that he'll curse them? That was one of the few really strong things I've heard Van Til say. He was usually very mild-mannered.
Well, did they sense that you were, did they know you were launching a new seminary that would pull away some students?
I don't know how soon they knew that, but because we had to get our board together first before
sure.
we do that. And in the fall, we immediately had three students, Francis Schaefer and the two youngs. And when it came, the summer was three-fourths over, I had a dream that fall came and they were the only students we had. and I should mention that there was a fine fellow who had, a good friend of mine who had done excellent work in school, and he had graduated, and he had been assistant in the library for a year or two, and we asked him, I talked with him, he said he was a mild amillennialist, and of course what that meant was, if you get into it exactly, it was really premillennialist, and in her little talk he came to the field of premillennialism. But he and Dr. Magnetar and I were going to meet on a Saturday to discuss plans to try to start a new seminary, and I said, I'm going for a walk up the country ways, and I'll come in on the 4 o'clock train on the Reading Railway, and they were to meet me at the station. We would go and discuss plans and talk about it. And so Carl Magnetar and Laird Harris met there, and I'd been walking all day, and I was sitting in the train. I fell asleep. The train stopped, and everybody left, and I woke up. So I got out of the car, and I had a cap on. They'd never seen me with a cap on before. And I got out, and you had to walk a long ways to the station there. And they had watched the people coming, looking for me. And then all the people came out, and then they saw one fellow alone, and they didn't even recognize me when I got up to the smoking. But that was the two of them, and we talked about it, and we talked about who we should get on our board. And, of course, our board had the secretary and treasurer and vice president of the Westminster Board. And we got a fine board. We drove up to Pine Brook to see Percy Crawford, to ask him to join our board. And we got there. I think we then went over to another Bible hunt. We saw Percy, and he agreed to join it. He was with us the first 3 years on the board. And then we went over to another Bible conference. And to see Dr. Blair, who was speaking there, and Dr. Broombaugh was speaking there. And then, while we were there, in walked, I can't think who it was unexpected, another man who became on our board. So anyway, the Lord just worked things together. It was wonderful. And in Wilmington, people said that on that street, they'd never seen a for sale sign in years on that particular block. A two-block stretch, and that summer there were four houses left for sale.
The Lord was really helping.
The Lord helped him every way. But I went to all these meetings, and Dr. Piper says, our church is a smaller church than it was last year, but it's a purer church. And that was the attitude, of course. And some of the students would come up to me after meetings, and they would say, we don't agree with you, but but we didn't like what was said about you tonight. We didn't like it at all. And but they had the students pretty well brainwashed. We only got, I think, two or three from the midwifery class. That's the freshman year before. But Dr. Buswell got us a lot of new students from Wheaton. We had 15 in our entering class. So we had an entering class which was larger proportion to the school we come from than Westminster. And the faculty was only Dr. Harris and me, and then we thought of Mr. Eppert, who had who was a pastor, and had a wonderful memory, tremendous memory. He read an awful lot of stuff. And he had studied in Scotland. And we had three of us, and then we had part-time teachers for 3 years. But the Lord blessed the work the next year. Next 2 or 3 years were, I wouldn't say the happiest of my life, because those first 3 years at Westminster were, but these came close to it.
Well, maybe we should conclude for today, I'd like to pick up next week on, just pick up the formation of a new denomination.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of tie that in, and also Machen's death and some of that background in there.
Yeah. Dr. Laird said that he did not think if Dr. Machen had lived, he could have turned against Westminster. He had such a loyalty to Dr. Machen. But on all the issues, he was 100%. But the personal loyalty to Dr. Machen would have held a lot of people.
Do you think that if Dr. Machen had lived, that you would have had to leave Westminster?
It's hard to predict what would have happened. See, the thing that really brought the crisis was the forming of the new church. That gave, that brought out the attitude that they were inculcating in these students. And, I think 3 years after that, after we started, they only had two entering students at Westminster. That fall, the school rocked along, and we had more students than they did for many years. Yeah. And it's only in the last few years that they had a wonderful growth.
And they seem to be changing some, at least some of the faculty attitudes and approaches seem to be broader, to the point that I've heard it said that Westminster West is viewed by some of the old guard as the true Westminster, and Westminster is now viewed as somewhat departed from this very strong OPC type of heritage and approach, etc. I don't want to caricature the situation.
And of course, a good bit of that here was Clowney's influence.
Yes, I think that.
Clowney was a most wonderful front man. He had such a Christian attitude on so many things.
And he's now in the PCA.
Yeah.
Of his own desire.
Do you think that there will be some reaction, or is some reaction at Westminster, against that rigid mindset to almost go in the other extreme, other direction?
I think it's more likely to be harmful.
Yeah.
In other words, fragmenting the
board
or the student body or the faculty, which would be the saddest, I think. But there's some potential in there for divisiveness. I fear. I hate to say that. But the
big thing to me is that, as I've often said, if you major on the minors, you're apt to minor on the majors. And when you put your emphasis on secondary points, you're apt to slide on major. I used to say there that I could, that I knew people who would recognize an Armenian three blocks off, but a modernist could walk right straight up to them. And they wouldn't see them wrong.
When did Dr. Machen pass away? Before, I should know this, but before Faith was formed?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So it was between the new church being formed and Faith being formed. Things happened very quickly there, right in the late 30s.
Well, the new church was was in existence 2 years before Hegel.
Okay, and he died.
He died
within those 2 years.
He died on January 1st, 1937. And we started in September
of 37. So he died only a matter of months before
All
this happened to you.
Because all these forces that had been underneath and that during 1 year roused so much antagonism to him, now they were kind of forgotten in the enthusiasm of starting a new church and leaving the apostasy and so on. And that was the big thing. But in these churches, these fellows were showing the attitudes that they had that had been ingrained into them by this teaching. And the result was, it was very obvious that to me that there wasn't much future for the church along the lines it was developing. And of course, he would have been, Dr. Machen, I mean, he'd have been right in the middle of that. It would have been very sad for him. Whether there ever could have been a new movement started, we'd have to wait 20 years. And you would have the OPC just as it is today, and that's all you had. Of course, if Machen lived to write another fine book like this, great books would have been wonderful. But Machen was a martyr to the cause of fighting the Presbyterian Church in the USA and trying to start a new church. He was a martyr to it. He went up to North Dakota, and where they had four little churches that were 50 miles from one to the other. Chaplain Myers used to, I was first impressed by him as he went to these little churches. And he would drive all those miles, you know, and go preaching all of them one Sunday. Just go from one to the other, you know. But Dr. Machen went up there in order to speak in these churches, and it was bitterly cold. And he was taken with the pneumonia. And they didn't know that was what it was yet. But he was taken with this illness, and he was determined to go through with his preaching with these little churches that had 20 or 30 people in each of them. But you had to drive 50 miles to get to them in that freezing cold weather. And they didn't have the warm equipment like we have now. And he got this, and he was feeling miserable, but he just pushed on, until in the end he just had to go to the hospital and had a couple of days in the hospital. Yeah, that was very sad. He was a martyr to it. But I fear greatly that if he had lived, of course Dr. Machen was ready to fight for any of his faculty. He'd have fought for me just as he fought for the rest of them. He was loyal to the whole faculty. And one time he made a sort of a discussion of me in the faculty meeting, and afterwards I wish I could have had that down on tape or at least had a record of what he said. It was beautiful. Well, I don't remember what he said, but it was beautiful.
Did he sense any of this attitude, this sea change kind of?
He sensed it, yeah. As he said to me, he says, why, we're making a big stand for the truth of the gospel. And he says, why can't they stand with us instead of knifing us in the back and criticizing us this way? Because he was talking about the students. The faculty in front of him were always most gracious. But it was what they inculcated in the students, and then that came out in the attitude.
Until he was kind of a martyr for the cause, and then that was all kind of forgotten, and he was a very much a patron saint figure kind of to the seminary from then on.
Yeah. Is this going? And we had a, I was still a member of the church, of course. We hadn't started a new church yet, and they had an assembly of the church, and everything. On every point, Dr. Machen said this, Dr. Machen said that, and Dr. Machen said that. And somebody presented a resolution against the excessive use of alcohol, the strongest, softest little thing you could ever imagine. But these students have been taught, you must stand for the right to drink alcohol. and they must so, and yet they were afraid that if the word got out, this was the wet church with the big feeling on prohibition in those days, it would hurt them. So they were in a quandary in a way, but they stood by what they believed in. Of course, they were quoting Dr. Machen all the time. So on one of these points, so I got it. I said last summer I was in the Canadian Rockies with Dr. Machen, and I said one day as we were going up the canyon there, I said I felt thirsty, and there was a rushing stream down in the bank down. I rushed down there and got a cup of water and drank it, and then I filled my cup again, and I went up and I offered it to Dr. Machen, and he says, "Oh," he says, "thank you, but I can't drink it." He says, "It's glacier water." He says, "Glacier water always gives me diarrhea, and I don't dare drink." He says, "I nearly died in these camps up in the mountains in Switzerland when I've been climbing, because all the water they had was glacier water, and I can't drink it." And he says, "I've been tempted to drink some of that very light, thin wine that they had there, but," he says, "I thought of it."
McCray then went on to say that Machen, of course, could not drink the wine so as to counter any notion that he was a drinker.